but at the time it had created quite a buzz. Three officers were killed, including one who had been pushed alive into one of the ovens, which meant that the prisoners had not died in vain. That had been a bad week for everyone else, as the SS officers took their anger out on every prisoner in the camp. But then it had passed, and we had assumed it was over. Until we huddled in the cold with our breath frosting before us and saw the women being led to the gallows. The gunpowder for the explosions had been traced to four girls who worked at a munitions factory. They would smuggle tiny amounts of powder, wrapped in cloth or paper, and hide it somewhere on their persons. Then it got passed to a girl who worked in the clothing division of our camp, who in turn smuggled it to prisoners who were part of the resistance movement, who got it to the Sonderkommando leaders in time for the uprising. The girl who worked in the clothing division lived in my block. She was a small mousy thing who did not give any appearance of being a rebel. "That's why she is a good one," Daria had pointed out. One day the girl had been dragged away from morning appel. We knew she had been put in the prison cells for a while, and badly tortured, and eventually sent back to live with us. But by then, she was completely broken. She couldn't speak, couldn't look at us. She pulled long strips of skin from her fingers and chewed her nails till they bled. Every night, without fail, she would scream in her sleep. Today she had been left behind in the block, and even now I could hear her shrieks. Her sister was one of the two girls being hanged. They were led to the gallows, wearing their normal work dresses, but no coats. They looked at us, clear-eyed, their heads held high. I could see the family resemblance between one of them and the girl from my block. The Schutzhaftlagerführer stood at the base of the gallows. At his command, another officer tied the girls' hands behind their backs. The first one was pulled up onto the table that stood beneath the gallows, and a noose was slipped around her neck. One moment she was standing, and the next she was pulled upward. The second girl followed. They twisted. Fish caught on the line. All that day, working in the office, I imagined I could hear the screams of the younger sister, whose execution had been delayed. It was impossible at this distance, but they were etched in my mind, an endless radio loop. It made me think of my own sister. For the first time, I thought that maybe Basha was right. Since she had been spared the horrors of a place like this, if you knew you were going to die, wasn't it better to choose the time and place, instead of waiting for fate to drop on you like an anvil? What if Basha's act wasn't one of desperation, but a final moment of self-control? The Hauptscharführer had chosen to save me last week. But that did not mean the next time he would be as generous. The only person I could truly depend on was myself. I imagined this was how the younger sister in my block felt when she began routing the gunpowder to the resistance. She wasn't any different from Basha. They both were just looking for a way out. I was so distracted that the Hauptscharführer asked if I had a headache. I did, but I knew it would get worse when I returned to the block at the end of the day. As it turned out, I needn't have worried. The sister and a fourth girl had been hanged just after the sun set, before appel. I tried not to look as I passed by, but I could hear the creak of the wood as their bodies twirled. Macabre ballerinas, with skirts that sang in the bitter wind. That night it grew so cold that we awakened with frost matting our hair. In the morning, when we were being given our rations, the Blokkelteste took a tin cup of coffee from one of the women and threw it into the air so that it froze instantly, a great white cloud. The dogs that patrolled with the officers now whined and pawed at the icy ground with their tails between their legs as we stood at Appell losing feeling in our extremities. When we walked to work afterward, we had to wrap our scarves around our heads or risk frostbite on any skin that was exposed. That week, the temperatures dipped so low, 22 women in our block died. Another 14 who were assigned to outside labor fell to the ground and froze to death. Daria brought me tights and a sweater from Canada so that I would have an extra layer. The price of a blanket on the black market at the camp quadrupled. I was never so grateful for my office job with the Hauptscharführer, but I knew that Daria in the unheated barracks of Canada was still in danger of freezing. So as I had done a few times before, when the Hauptscharführer left to get his lunch, I hurriedly typed a note on a stolen piece of his letterhead, requesting that prisoner A18557 report to his office. Bundling myself into my coat and hat and mittens and scarf, I hurried across the camp to Canada to deliver the message and bring my best friend out of the cold, if for only a few minutes. We huddled together, arm in arm, and Daria slipped into my mitten a small piece of chocolate she had squirreled away during her work. We didn't talk. It took too much energy. Even after we had entered the building, we had to keep up the pretense that Daria had been summoned by the Hauptscharführer. We passed SS officers and guards and kept our eyes averted. By this point I was known to them, nothing suspicious. As was my habit when I reached the office door, I turned the knob first and peeked inside, just in case I had miscalculated and the Hauptscharführer had returned. There was someone in the room. Behind the Hauptscharführer's desk was a safe. In it was the money that was found at Canada, which was shipped out daily under lock and key. Each time the Hauptscharführer made his rounds of Canada, he would empty the box that sat in the center of the barracks where valuables were kept. The smaller items, like bills and coins and diamonds, were brought to his office. As far as I knew, the only person who had the combination to the safe was the Hauptscharführer himself. But now, as I saw the Schutzhaftlagerführer standing in front of its open door, I realized I was wrong. He was slipping a stack of currency into the inside breast pocket of his coat. I saw his eyes widen as he stared at me as if I were a ghost. An upyur. Something that was supposed to be dead. I realized that he had assumed I was killed last week when the Oberführer from Oranien had come and systematically liquidated all the Jews working in office jobs. I started to back out of the room, panicked. I had to get out of there, and I had to get Daria out of there. But even if we were able to break through the fence and escape to Russia, it would not have been far enough. As long as I knew that the Schutzhaftlagerführer was stealing, and as long as I worked for his brother, I could turn him in. Which meant he'd have to get rid of me. "Run!" I yelled to Daria, as the Schutzhaftlagerführer's hand closed over my wrist. Daria paused, and that was just enough time for the officer to grab her by the hair with his other hand and drag her into the office. He closed the door behind us. "What do you think you saw?" he demanded. I shook my head, looking at the ground. "Speak!" I saw nothing, Herr Schutzhaftlagerführer. Beside me, Daria slipped her hand into mine. The Schutzhaftlagerführer saw the slight movement, the rustle between our dresses. I don't know what he thought at that moment, that we were passing a note, that we had some kind of code, or simply that if he let us go, I would tell my friend what he had done, and then there would be two people who knew his secret. He pulled his pistol out of its holster and shot Daria in the face. She fell, still holding on to my hand. The plaster wall behind us exploded in a rain of dust. I started to scream. My best friend's blood spattered my face and my dress. I couldn't hear anything after the blast of the gunshot. I fell to my hands and knees, rocking, hugging what was left of Daria, waiting for the bullet that was destined for me. Rainer? What are you doing in here, for the love of God? The Hauptschaftführer's voice sounded like it was coming through a tunnel, like I'd been wrapped in layers of cotton batting. I looked up at him, still screaming. The Schutzhaftlagerführer pulled me upright by the throat. I caught these two stealing from you, Franz. It is a good thing I happened to come in when I did. He held out the wad of currency that he had been tucking into his coat. The Hauptscharführer set down a tray of food on the desk and looked at me. You did this? It didn't matter what I said, I realized. Even if the Hauptscharführer believed me, his brother would be watching me at every moment, waiting for a chance to do to me what he had done to Daria, so that I would not tell the Hauptscharführer what I had seen. Oh, God! Daria! I shook my head, sobbing. No, Herr Hauptscharführer. The Schutzhaftlagerführer laughed. What did you think she would say, and why would you even bother to ask? A muscle jumped along the Hauptscharführer's jaw. You know there are procedures, he said. The prisoner should have been arrested, not shot. What are you going to do? Report me? When his brother didn't respond, the Schutzhaftlagerführer's face went as red as it did when he was drunk. I make the procedures. Who would contest what I did? This prisoner was found stealing property from the Reich. It was the same infraction that had brought me to this office in the first place. I stopped her in the commission of the crime. The same should be done of her accomplice, even if she is your little whore. The Schutzhaftlagerführer shrugged. If you do not punish her, Franz, then I will. To underscore his point, he cocked the trigger on his pistol again. I felt something warm run down my leg, and realized, to my dismay, that I had urinated. A small puddle spread on the floor between my wooden shoes. The Hauptscharführer stepped toward me. I did not do what he says, I whispered. Tucked inside my dress was the journal with the 10 pages I had written last night. Alexander locked in a prison cell, Anya breaking into the jail to see him the morning before his public execution. Please, he begged her, do one thing for me. Anything, Anya promised. Kill me, he said. If this had been any ordinary day, the Hauptscharführer would be settling down to hear me read that aloud. But this was not any ordinary day. In the 4 months I had worked for the Hauptscharführer, he had never laid a hand on me. Now he did. He cupped his hand around my cheek so gently that it brought tears to my eyes. His thumb stroked my skin the way one would touch a lover, and he met my gaze. Then he hit me so hard that he broke my jaw. When I couldn't stand up anymore, when I was spitting bloody saliva into my sleeve to keep from choking, when the Schutzhaftlagerführer was satisfied, the Hauptschauführer stopped. He stumbled away from me as if he were coming out of a trance, and looked around his ravaged office. "Clean up this mess," he ordered. He left me under the supervision of another guard, who was ordered to take me to the prison cells as soon as I was finished. I gingerly righted the furniture, wincing when I twisted or moved too quickly. I swept up the plaster dust with my hands. My eyes kept drifting to where Daria lay on the floor, and every time I looked at her, I felt like I was going to be sick. So I took off my coat and wrapped her upper body in it. She was already stiffening, her limbs cold and rigid. I started to shake, with cold, with grief, with shock, and forced myself to go to the janitorial closet and find cleaning supplies, rags, a bucket. I scrubbed the floor. Twice I passed out from the pain caused by the exertion. And twice the guard poked me with his boot to nudge me back into consciousness. When the office was clean again, I lifted Daria into my arms. She weighed nothing, but neither did I, and I staggered at the additional burden. With the guard directing me, I carried my best friend, still wrapped in my coat, from the administration building in the frigid cold, to a wagon that stood at the outskirts of Canada. In it were other bodies, people who had died overnight, people who had died during the workday. With all the strength I had, I lifted her into the wagon. The only thing that kept me from climbing in there with her was knowing she would hate to know I'd given up. The guard grabbed my arm, pulling at me to leave her. I tugged away from him, risking more punishment. I unwrapped the coat from around Daria's torso and slipped into it. There was no body heat left in her to transfer to me. I reached for her hand, flecked with red measles spots of her own blood, and kissed it. Before she was hanged, the girl who had come back to our block after being imprisoned had whispered wildly of the Stehzelle, the starvation cell you had to enter through a tiny door like a dog kennel. The cell was built narrow and tall, so that you could not sit down at all. Instead, you had to stand overnight, with mice running across your feet, until you were released the next morning and expected to carry on through your workday. By the time I was brought to one of these, in a building I had never entered in the months I'd been here, I was numb. The cold had robbed me of feeling in my hands and feet and face, which was good, because it kept my jaw from aching. I could not speak without tearing up from the pain, and that was fine, because I had nothing left to say. Drifting in and out of consciousness, I imagined that my mother was here. She wrapped her arms around me and kept me warm. She whispered in my ear, "Be a mensch, Minusha." For the first time I realized what that really meant. As long as you put someone else's welfare in front of your own, it meant you had someone else to live for. Once that was gone, what was the point? I wondered what would become of me. The commandant might issue a decree for my punishment, a beating, a whipping, death. But the Schutzhaftlagerführer might not even bother to follow rules, and could simply take me out of here himself and shoot me. He might say he caught me escaping. Another lie. one impossible to believe with me locked up in this cell. And yet, who would stop him? Who would really care if he killed another Jew? Only the Hauptschauführer, possibly. Or so I had thought, until today. I was asleep on my feet, dreaming of Daria. She burst into the office where I was working and told me I had to leave immediately, but I could not make myself stop typing. With every key I struck, another bullet exploded into her chest, her head. Herr Dibuk, that was what I had called him before I knew his rank and name. Someone whose body had been taken over, unwillingly, by a demon. I could not tell you which man was the real one. The officer who would beat an employee to the point of losing consciousness? Or the officer who went out of his way to see a prisoner as a fellow human being? He had tried to tell me during all those lunchtime literary sessions that there is good and evil in all of us. That a monster is just someone for whom the evil has tipped the balance. And I had been naive enough to believe him. I woke with a start when I felt a hand on my ankle. I gasped, and the hand gripped me tighter, willing me into silence. The grate that opened the cell scraped open, and I lowered myself through it. Standing there was a guard who tied my hands behind my back. I assumed it was morning. I had no idea, as there were no windows in here, and that it was time for him to take me to work. But where? Was I expected to go back to the Hauptschauführer? I did not know if I could stand to be in the same small space as him. It was not the beating I'd received that made me feel this way. After all, I had been hurt by other officers, and had continued to see them day after day. It was simply the way of life here. No, it was not the Hauptschauführer's brutality, but rather the kindness that had come before it, that made it so hard for me to understand. I started to pray that maybe, instead, I'd be placed on one of the penal gangs that had to work in the brutal cold, moving rocks for the next 12 hours. I could accept the harshness of the elements, just not that of a German I had been stupid enough to trust. I was not brought to the administration building, and I was not brought to the penal gang, either. Instead, I was taken to the ramp where the railway cars came into the camp, and the selections were made. There were other prisoners there, being herded into the cars. It made no sense to me, because I knew that the process never worked in reverse. The train cars emptied here, and the people who spilled out of them never left. The guard pulled me behind the platform and untied my hands. He seemed to have a very hard job of it, taking more time than necessary. Then he shoved me into a line of women who were being loaded into one of the cars. I was lucky. I was still wearing my coat, dried with Daria's blood, and my hat and mittens and scarf. I had the journal with my story tucked into my undergarments. I grabbed onto one of the male prisoners, whose job involved herding us inside. "Where?" I gritted out, my teeth clenched against the pain in my jaw. "Großhosen," he muttered. I knew it was another camp, because I had seen the name on documents. It could not possibly be any worse than it was here. Inside the train car, I moved to a spot near the window. It would be cold, but there would be fresh air. I slid along the wall to a sitting position, feeling my legs burn after the hours I'd spent standing, and I wondered why I had been brought here. It was possible this was the punishment that had been handed down from the Kommandant for stealing. Or it was possible that someone had been trying to save me from a worse fate, by making sure I was on a train that would take me far away from the Schutzhaftlagerführer. After what he had done to me, I had no reason to believe that the Hauptscharführer was thinking about me at all, or even wondering if I'd survived the night. That was probably a figment of my imagination. But then again, my imagination was what had kept me alive all these months in this hellhole. It was not until hours later, when we had arrived at Großrosen, to learn that there was not a women's compound, and we would be taken on instead to a sub-camp called Neusalz, that I took off my mittens to gently test the tenderness of my jaw, and something fell into my lap. A tiny scroll. A note. I realized that the guard who had untied my wrists had not been having trouble with the knots. He had slipped this into my mitten. It was a strip of watermarked paper, the same kind I had rolled into my typewriter every day for the past few months. "What happens next?" it read. I never saw the Hauptscharführer again. At Neusalz, I worked in the Gruschwitz textile factory. My job at first involved making thread, a deep red hue that stained my hands. But because I had worked at an office job and had access to food, I was stronger than most of the other women, and soon I was sent to load train cars with boxes of ammunition. We worked alongside political prisoners, Poles and Russians, who unloaded the supplies that came by rail. One of the Poles would flirt with me whenever I came close to the tracks. Although we were not supposed to talk to each other, he would pass me notes when the guards were not looking. He called me Pinky because of my mittens. He would whisper limericks to make me laugh. Some of the other women joked around with me about my boyfriend and said that he must have a thing for girls who played hard to get. In reality, I wasn't playing hard to get at all. I didn't speak for fear I'd be punished, and because it still hurt to move my jaw. I had been at the factory for only 2 weeks when one day he came closer to me than the guards allowed. "Escape if you can. This camp is going to be evacuated." I didn't know what that meant. Would we be taken somewhere and shot? Would we be brought to another camp, a death camp like the one I'd left? Or would I be sent back to Auschwitz and the Schutzhaftlagerführer? I moved away from the POW as quickly as I could, before he got me into trouble. I didn't tell the other women in my barracks what he had said. 3 days later, instead of being made to report to our work details, the 900 women in the camp were assembled and, under guard, marched out of the gates. We walked about 10 miles before dawn. Women who had gathered their meager belongings, blankets and pots and whatever else they had squirreled away at the camp, began to drop them on the sides of the road. We were headed toward Germany. That was all we could surmise. In the front of the convoy, prisoners pulled a wagon that prepared meals for the SS officers. Another wagon at the back of the line held the bodies of those who collapsed from exhaustion and died. The Germans were trying to cover their tracks, I supposed. At least that was the way it worked for the first few days. And then the officers just got lazy, shot those who fell, and left them lying there. The rest of us would simply step around them, like water parted by a stone in a stream. We hiked through forests, We hiked through fields. We hiked through towns where people came to stare at us as we passed, some with tears in their eyes and some spitting at us. When there were Allied warplanes overhead, the officers would slip between us, using us as camouflage. The hunger was worst, but a close second was the condition of my feet. Some of the women were lucky enough to have boots. I was still wearing the wooden clogs that I'd been given at Auschwitz. My skin was blistered beneath the multiple stockings I wore. Splinters from the wood had rubbed holes in the heels of at least two of the layers. Where snow had seeped into the wool, my skin was nearly frostbitten. And still, I did not have it as bad as some of the other girls. One, who had only a single pair of stockings, got such bad frostbite that her little toe snapped off like an icicle from a roof. This went on for a week. I no longer told myself I had to survive the day, but just one more hour. All this exercise and no food took its toll. I could feel myself wasting away, weakening. I had not believed it was possible to be any hungrier than I already was, but I had not understood what this march would be like. At rest stops, when the officers prepared their own meals, we were left to melt snow so that we would have water to drink. We'd forage through the melting drifts for acorns and bits of moss that we could eat. We never spoke. We were just too weary to muster up the energy. After each of these stops, there were at least a dozen women who could not get to their feet again. Then, the SS executioner, a Ukrainian with a wide, flat nose and a bulbous Adam's apple, would finish them off with a single shot to the back. 10 days into the march, at one of the rest stops, the officers made a fire. They tossed potatoes into the flames and dared us to reach in and grab one. There were girls so desperate to get a potato that they set their sleeves on fire, then rolled in the snow to put out the flames, which made the officers laugh. Some, who had been successful in getting a potato, would eventually die from the burns. After a while, the potatoes charred to ash because no one else would reach in for them. It was worse, I think, seeing that food go to waste than simply starving. That night, one woman who had suffered third-degree burns on her hands was screaming from the pain. I was lying beside her and trying to calm her down by packing her arms with fresh snow. "This will help," I soothed. "You just have to stop thrashing." But she was Hungarian and didn't understand me, and I didn't know how else to help her. After hours of her shrieks, the executioner approached. He stepped over me and shot her, then went back to the spot where the officers were sleeping. I coughed, unable to breathe anything but gunpowder residue, and then wrapped my scarf over my mouth as a filter. The other women around me did not even react. I reached down and untied the boots that the dead woman was wearing. She would not need them anymore. They were too big, but they were better than the wooden clogs. The next morning, before we left the camp the officers had made, I was told to douse the fire. I did, with snow, but noticed the charred remains of the potatoes among the embers. I reached in and picked one up. It crumbled at my touch into a heap of ash, but surely there was still some nutritious value. As quickly as possible, I grabbed handfuls of the ash into my pockets, and for days after that, as I walked, I would stick my fingers into my coat and scoop out bits to eat. When we had been marching for 2 weeks, I thought about the POW who had urged me to escape, and now I understood. There were incremental grades of surrender. from the women who kicked off their clogs because the blisters on their feet made it impossible to walk anymore, and who then suffered such severe frostbite and gangrene that they died, to those who simply lay down and did not get up, knowing they would be dead within minutes. Well, it seemed that we were all dying by degrees. Eventually there would be none of us left. Which, maybe, was the point of this march. And then, it seemed, there was an iota of mercy in the form of springtime. The days grew warmer, the snow melted in patches. This was a gift in that I knew soon things would begin to grow. And that meant food. But it also depleted our reserve of unlimited water and created mud bogs we had to slog through. We marched through villages where we would sleep in the streets while the SS men took turns sleeping inside homes and churches. Then we would wake up and edge into the forests again, where it was harder for the warplanes to spot us. One afternoon I was assigned to pull the wagon at the front of the convoy when I saw something sticking out of the mud. An apple core. Someone must have thrown it away in the woods. A farmer, maybe. A boy whistling as he ran through the trees. I looked at the SS officers walking beside the wagon. If I let go for a second, I could run over and pick up the core and slip it into my pocket without them noticing. I was fully aware that in 6 steps, 5, 4, we would be past it, and it would be too late. I also knew from the charge that ran through our ragged line that I was not the only one to have seen it. I dropped the handle of the wagon and ran to grab it. I was not fast enough. An SS man yanked me upright before my fingers could close around the core. He dragged me from my position at the front of the convoy to the rear, where 2 more officers secured my arms so that I couldn't blend into the line of prisoners. I knew what would happen, because I had seen it before. When we stopped again to rest, the executioner would take me into the woods and would kill me. My knees were knocking, making it difficult to walk. When the wagon in the front pulled to the side to make the evening meal, the executioner took my arm and led me away from the other women. I was the only one assigned to be executed that afternoon. By now, it was twilight. The sky was a dusky purple that would have taken my breath away under any other circumstance. The executioner motioned for me to get down on my knees in front of him. I did, but clasped my hands together and started to beg. "Please, if you spare my life, I'll give you something in return." I don't know why I made this promise. I had nothing of value. Everything I'd brought with me from Neusalz I wore on my body. Then I remembered the leather journal, which I had slipped into the waistband of my dress. There was nothing about this thuggish man that suggested he was a scholar of literature, or that he even knew how to read. But I lifted my arms in a signal of surrender, and then slowly reached beneath my coat for the book in which I had written my story. "Please," I repeated, "take this." He frowned, dismissing the barter at first. But most prisoners did not have a fine, leather-bound journal in their possession. I could see him wondering if maybe there was something important written inside. He reached toward me. As soon as his hand clasped the binding, I took my other hand, now resting on the ground, and grabbed a handful of dirt, which I threw into his eyes. Then I ran, faster than I'd ever run, into the night, which bled like a mortal wound between the trees. I would not have escaped if not for several favorable conditions. One, it was dusk, the most difficult time of the day for my captors to see. Trees became soldiers pointing guns, and the keen eyes of owls could be mistaken for fugitives. Boulders resembled enemy tanks, and every animal's footfall made them fear they'd walked into an ambush. Two, the officers had no dogs with them, the march being deemed too grueling for animals, so I couldn't be tracked by my scent. Three, the mud. Four, the fact that the officers were just as weary of this march as I was. I ran until I collapsed, and by then I could hear the shouts of the SS men who were searching for me. I stumbled, rolling in the near dark down a ravine, landing in a trench at the bottom. I covered my body and my face with the wet mud and drew branches and brush across me. Then I lay as still as I could. At one point the Germans passed so close that one of the officers stepped on the back of my hand. But I did not make a sound. And he did not realize I was hiding beneath his boots. Eventually they moved on. I waited a full day before I believed it, and then began to pick my way through the forest. I walked by moonlight, afraid to sleep because of the wild animals that I heard calling to each other. Just when I was certain I would have to lie down and take my chances with the wolves, I saw something in the distance, a looming shadow, a broad-hipped roof, a haystack. The barn smelled of pigs and chickens. When I slipped inside, the birds were roosting, gossiping to each other like old ladies, too busy to even send up the alarm that I had entered. I felt my way in the slurry dark, wincing when my foot struck a metal pail. But in spite of the clatter, no one came. No lights in the house down the path flickered on. And so I continued to rummage. A deep wooden barrel filled with grain squatted just outside the fence of the pig pen. I dug both hands into the barrel and ate fistfuls of the food, which tasted of sawdust and molasses and oats. I tried hard not to eat too fast because I knew it would only make me sick. Climbing over the low railing, I pushed two large sows out of the way and dug my hands into a trough. Potato peels, fruit rinds, the heels of bread. This was a banquet. Eventually, I lay down with the pigs on either side of me, warmed by their bristled backs and shielded by their bulk. For the first time in 5 years, I fell asleep so stuffed that even if I had tried, I could not have eaten another bite. I dreamed that I had been shot by the executioner after all, because surely this was heaven. Or so I thought, until I woke up to find a pitchfork pointed at my throat. The woman was about the same age that my mother had been, with a coronet of braids twisted around her head and lines bracketing her mouth. She poked the weapon at my throat, and I scrambled backward as the animals grunted and squealed around me. I threw up my hands in surrender. "Bitte!" I cried, struggling to my feet. I was so weak I had to grab onto the railing of the pig pen to do it. She held the pitchfork aloft, but then, slowly, so incredibly slowly, lowered the tines, holding it instead across her body like a barrier. She tilted her head, staring. I could only imagine what she was seeing. A skeleton with mud caking my skin and my hair, my striped prisoner's coat, and my filthy pink mittens and hat. "Bitte," I murmured again. She put down the pitchfork and ran out of the barn, closing the heavy door behind her. The pigs were chewing on the laces of my stolen boots. The chickens, sitting on the railing between the coop and the pig pen, flapped their wings and cackled. I reached over the wooden gate and opened the latch so that I could step outside. This farmer's wife had left because she was terrified. But that didn't mean she wasn't on her way back right now with her husband and a shotgun. Hurriedly, I filled my pockets with more of the pig grain I'd eaten last night because I didn't know when I would have food again. Before I could slip out the door, however, it opened again. The farmer's wife stood there with a loaf of bread, a jug of milk, and a platter of sausage. She walked toward me. "You must eat," she whispered. I hesitated, wondering if this was a trap. But in the end, I was too hungry to let the chance pass. I grabbed a sausage off the plate and stuffed it into my mouth. I tore off a hunk of bread and tucked it into the side of my cheek, since my jaw was still too sore to chew. I drained the jug of milk, feeling it pour down my chin and neck. How long had it been since I had fresh milk? Then I wiped my hand across my mouth, embarrassed to have acted like such an animal in front of this woman. "Where did you come from?" she asked. She spoke German, which meant we must have crossed into Germany by now. Was it possible that there were ordinary citizens who had no idea what was happening in Poland? Had they been lied to by the SS like we had? Before I could think of what to say, she shook her head. "It's better if you don't tell me. You stay. It will be safe." I had no reason to trust her. It was true that most of the Germans I had met had been brutal terrorists without conscience, but there had also been a Herr Bauer, a Herr Fassbinder, a Hauptscharführer. So I nodded. She motioned to the hayloft. There was a ladder leading up to it and a shaft of sunlight spilling through a crack in the roof. Still holding the piece of bread she had given me, I began to climb. I lay down on a bed of hay and fell asleep before the farmer's wife had even closed the barn door behind her again. It was hours before I awakened to the sound of footsteps below. I peeked down the ladder to see the farmer's wife lugging a metal pail inside. Draped around her neck was a white towel, and in her free arm was a stack of folded clothing. She motioned when she saw my face. "Come," she said gently. I crawled down the ladder and shifted uneasily from foot to foot. The woman patted a hay bale so that I would sit. Then she knelt at my feet. She dipped a washcloth into the water in the pail and leaned forward, carefully wiping my brow, my cheeks, my chin. The washcloth, dark with mud and grime, she rinsed off in the bucket again. I let her wash my arms and my legs. The water was warm, a luxury. When she began to unbutton my work dress, I pulled away until she cupped my shoulders in her capable hands. "Shh," she murmured, turning me away from her. I felt the rough fabric being peeled from my body, falling to the floor in a puddle at my feet. I felt the washcloth on every pearl of my spine, on the angular planes of my hip bones. the fortress of my ribcage. When she turned me to face her, there were tears in her eyes. I crossed my arms in front of my bare body, ashamed to see myself through her eyes. After I was dressed in the clean clothing, soft cotton and wool as if I had been wrapped in a cloud, she brought another bucket of clean water and a bar of soap and washed my hair for me. She used her fingers to scrub out the mud, and she cut the mats that could not be worked free. Then she sat behind me, the way my mother used to do, and brushed it. Sometimes, all it takes to become human again is someone who can see you that way, no matter how you present on the surface. For 5 days, the farmer's wife came to me with meals, breakfasts of fresh eggs and rye toast and gooseberry jam, lunches of sliced cheese on thick hanks of bread, suppers of chicken thighs with root vegetables. Slowly, I grew more alert, stronger. The blisters on my feet healed. My jaw stopped aching. I was able to pace myself so that I did not stuff my face with the food as soon as she set it in front of me. We did not speak about where I'd come from or where I would be going. I tried to convince myself that I could stay here, in the barn, until the war was over. I was once again at the mercy of a German. But like a dog that has been kicked so often it shies away from any kind hand, I was slowly being coaxed into believing that I might be able to trust. In return, I tried to show my gratitude. I cleaned out the chicken coop, a job that took me hours because I had to keep sitting to rest. I collected the eggs and had them neatly piled in a pail when the farmer's wife arrived each afternoon. I cleaned cobwebs from the rafters and swept the hayloft so that you could see the wooden floor beneath the bales. One night, the woman did not come. I felt a pang of hunger, but it was nothing like what I'd experienced in the camp or on the march. I had gone without for so long that missing a single meal now almost didn't register. Maybe she was ill. Maybe she had taken a trip. The next morning, when the barn door slid open, I crawled down the ladder quickly, aware that I had missed her company more than I even let myself know. The farmer's wife stood with the sun silhouetting her, so it took me a moment to realize that her eyes were red and puffy, that she was not alone. A man, wearing a flannel shirt and suspenders, who leaned heavily on a cane, stood behind her. With him was a member of the police force. The light leached from my smile. I was rooted to the barn floor, gripping the ladder so hard the wood bit into the skin beneath my fingernails. "I'm sorry," the farmer's wife choked out. But that was all she said, because her husband gave her a firm shake. The police officer bound my hands together, then pulled the barn door wide and led me to a truck that was idling in the driveway. My mother used to say that sometimes if you turn a tragedy over in your hand, you can see a miracle running through it, like fool's gold in the hardest shard of rock. This was certainly true of the deaths of my family, if only because they did not live to see me in this state, to see the world in this state. The murder of another woman had yielded me a pair of sturdy boots. If not for the march from Neusalz, I would never have found this barn, and had nearly a week of 3 square meals in my belly. And if the farmer had indeed discovered his wife's secret stowaway, and he had called the police to turn me in, at least it meant that I would travel to this next camp in the back of a truck, conserving strength I would never have had if I'd walked the entire distance. Which is why, when we arrived at Flossenbürg on March 11, 1945, the same day, ironically, as those who had begun the march from Neusalz, more than half of those women were dead. But I was still alive. A week later, we were put onto trains and taken to another camp. We arrived at Bergen-Belsen the last week of March. In the cars, we had been stacked like cans on a grocery shelf, so that shifting even a little meant a foot in your face or a grunt from someone else. And everyone was trying desperately to get away from the overflowing bucket we used as a latrine. When the train stopped, we staggered out, holding on to each other as if we had been drinking heavily. I managed only a few steps before I sank down. The first thing I noticed was the smell. I couldn't describe it even if I tried. The burning flesh of Auschwitz was nothing compared to this, the stink of disease and piss and shit and death. It got into your nostrils and throat and left you breathing shallowly through your mouth. Everywhere there were stacks of the dead, some haphazard, some neatly arranged like building blocks or a house of cards. Those healthy enough to move were hauling the bodies away. Everyone at this camp had typhus. How could they not, when there were hundreds of people crammed into barracks meant for 50, when the latrine facility was a hole outside, when there wasn't enough food or fresh water for the thousands of prisoners who had been trucked in? We did not work. We rotted. We would curl like snails on the floor of the barracks, because that was the only way we could all fit. Guards would come in to dispose of the dead. Sometimes they would take the living, too. It was an honest mistake. We didn't always know which was which. All night long there would be soft moans, skin blistering with fever, hallucinations. Then we would shuffle outside in the morning for appel, lining up to be counted for hours. I became friendly with a woman named Tauba, who with her daughter Sure used to live in Hrubieszów. Tauba had a prized possession, one she held on to as fiercely as I had once held on to my leather journal. It was a threadbare, lice-infested blanket. She and Sura had used it on the march that brought them here, braving the snow and the elements and surviving the nights when others died of the cold. Now, Tauba used it to warm Sura, who fell sick just days after arriving at the camp. She would wrap her daughter in the blanket and rock her back and forth, singing lullabies. When it was time for appel, Tauba and I would hold Sura upright between the vice of our bodies. One night, in her dream state, Sura begged for food. Tauba held her closer. "What would you like me to cook for you?" she whispered. "Maybe a roast chicken with gravy and candied carrots and whipped potatoes." Her eyes were bright with tears, with butter. A big dollop, like snow on the top of a mountain. She hugged Sura more tightly, and the girl's head snapped back on its delicate stem. "In the morning, when you are hungry again, I will bring you my special pancakes, stuffed with cottage cheese and sprinkled with sugar, baked beans and eggs and brown bread and fresh blueberries. There will be so much food, Sura, that you will not be able to finish it." I knew that some of the stronger women had managed to get to the kitchens and find food in the waste bins. I didn't know why they weren't punished. It was either because the guards didn't want to get too close to us and risk illness, or because no one cared anymore. But the next morning, after making sure Sura was still breathing, I followed a small contingency to the kitchen. "What do we do?" I asked, nervous about standing around in broad daylight. But then again, it wasn't as if we were skipping a work detail. There was nothing for us to do at this camp but wait. Did it matter if we were here, underneath a kitchen window, instead of in a barracks? The window opened, and a sturdy woman tossed a pail of scraps out. Potato peels, ersatz coffee grounds, rinds from sausages and oranges, the bones from a roast. The women fell to the ground like animals, grabbing what they could. In my moment's hesitation, I lost out on the most valuable bits of refuse, but I managed to get a wishbone from a chicken and a handful of potato peels. I slipped these into my pocket and hurried back to Tauba and Sura. I handed the potato peels to Tauba, who tried to coax her daughter into sucking on one. But Sura had slipped into unconsciousness. "Then you eat it," I urged. "When she gets better, she'll need your strength." Tauba shook her head. "I wish I could believe that." I reached into my pocket for the bone I'd taken. When I was little and my sister Basha and I both wanted something very badly, like a new wagon or a trip to the country, we would make a deal, I told Tauba. When Mama cooked her Shabbat chicken and we got the wishbone, we'd wish for the same thing. That way, it couldn't help but come true. I held up the bone, curling my fingers around one side of its slingshot neck, letting Tauba curl her fingers around the other. "Ready?" I asked. The bone broke in her favor, but it would not have mattered either way. That night, when the capo came to sort through the dead, Sura's body was the first one taken. I listened to Tauba keening, turned inside out by loss. She buried her face in the blanket, all she had left of her daughter. But even muffled, her cries turned into shrieks. I covered my ears and still could not block them out. The shrieks became knives, poised like daggers around the crown of my face. I watched with wonder as they pierced my sunken skin, releasing not blood, but fire. Minka. Minka? Tauba's face swam into my vision, as if I were lying on the bottom of the sea and staring up at the sun. Minka, you've got the fever. I was shaking uncontrollably now, my clothes soaked in sweat. I knew how this would turn out. In a few days' time, I would be dead. Then, Tauba did the most amazing thing. She took that blanket, and she tore it in half. She wrapped part of it around my shoulders. If I was going to die, I wanted to do it on my own terms. In this, I was like my sister after all. It would not be in a fetid hut, surrounded by the sick. I would not let the last person who made a decision about me be a guard, hauling my corpse somewhere to decompose in the midday sun. So I staggered outside, where the air was cooler against my skin. I pulled the blanket tight around me, and I collapsed on the ground. I knew I was saving someone the trouble of carting my body out in the morning. But for now, I shook in the throes of my fever, and I looked up at the night sky. There had not been many stars in Łódź. It was too big and dynamic a city. But my father had taught me the constellations when I was a girl, and we had traveled to the countryside on vacation. There would be just the four of us, staying at a rented cottage by a lake, fishing and reading and hiking and playing backgammon. My mother always beat the rest of us at board games, but my father always caught the biggest fish. At night, sometimes, my father and I would sleep on the porch, where the air was so fresh that you drank it instead of simply breathing. My father taught me about Leo, the constellation directly overhead, named for yet another mythical monster, the Nemean lion, a giant, ferocious beast with skin that couldn't be penetrated by knives or swords. Hercules' first task was to slay it, but he realized quickly that the lion couldn't be shot with arrows. Instead, he chased the monster into a cave, stunned it with a blow to the head, and strangled it. As proof of his victory, he used the lion's own claws to skin its pelt. "You see, Minka," my father would say, "anything is possible. Even the most terrible beast might one day be a distant memory." He would hold my hand in his, tracing my finger along the brightest stars in the constellation. "Look," he would say, "there is the head and the tail. There's the heart." I was dead, and I was looking at the wing of an angel. White and ethereal, it swooped and dove in the corner of my vision. But if I was dead, why did my head feel as heavy as an anvil? Why could I still smell the horrible stench of this place? I struggled to sit up and realized that what I had imagined as a wing was a flag, a strip of cloth fluttering in the wind. It was tied to the guard tower that stood across from the barracks where I had been housed. That guard tower was empty. So was the one behind it. There were no officers walking around. No Germans, period. It was like a ghost town. By then, some of the other prisoners had begun to figure out what had happened. "Get up," one woman yelled. "Get up, they are all gone." I was swept in a tide of humanity toward the fence. Had they left us here to starve to death? Were any of us strong enough to tear down the barbed wire? In the distance were trucks with red crosses painted on the sides. At that moment, I knew it didn't matter if we weren't strong enough. There were others now who would be strong for us. There is a picture of me from that day. I saw it once on a PBS documentary about April 15, 1945, when the first British tanks approached Bergen-Belsen. I was shocked to see my face on the body of a skeleton. I even bought a copy of the video so that I could play it and stop it at the right moment and make sure. But yes, that was me, with my pink hat and mittens, and Sura's blanket wrapped around my shoulders. I've told no one that this was me in someone's camera footage until now. I weighed 67 pounds on the day the British liberated us. A man in a uniform approached me, and I fell into his arms, unable to stand any longer. He swung me up and carried me to a tent that was serving as an infirmary. "You are free," they said over the loudspeakers, in English, in German, in Yiddish, in Polish. "You are free. Be calm. Food is coming. Help is on the way." You will ask me after this why I didn't tell you this before. It is because I know how powerful a story can be. It can change the course of history. It can save a life. But it can also be a sinkhole, a quicksand, in which you become stuck, unable to write yourself free. You would think bearing witness to something like this would make a difference. And yet, this isn't so. In the newspapers I have read about history repeating itself, in Cambodia, Rwanda, Sudan, truth is so much harder than fiction. Some survivors want to speak only of what happened. They go to schools and museums and temples and give talks. It's the way they can make sense of it, I suppose. I've heard them say they feel it is their responsibility, maybe even the reason they lived. My husband, your grandfather, used to say, "Minka, you were a writer. Imagine the story you could tell." But it is exactly because I was a writer that I could never do it. The weapons an author has at her disposal are flawed. There are words that feel shapeless and overused. Love, for example. I could write the word love 1,000 times, and it would mean 1,000 different things to different readers. What is the point of trying to put down on paper emotions that are too complex, too huge, too overwhelming to be confined by an alphabet? Love isn't the only word that fails. Hate does, too. War. And hope. Oh, yes. Hope. So, you see, this is why I never told my story.